Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly roundup of local news from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today, the role of Utah senators in the at times contentious confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Speculation about the author of an anonymous New York Times op-ed with a Utah twist. The Mia Love-Ben McAdams race takes a negative turn. And ads attacking a medical marijuana ballot initiative are pulled from local airwaves following complaints that they were misleading. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry. And good morning, Dan. Thanks
good morning, Roger.
Also, we've got editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. George, hello and welcome.
Good morning.
And on the phone, we've got Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning.
If you've got questions or comments about the stories we are covering, call us up. We are at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Or you can post them at sltrib.com. This might be kind of an unusual place to start, but I think to begin with today, we'll go with an anonymous op-ed published in the New York Times written by a senior Trump administration official. The headline was, "I am part of the resistance inside the Trump administration." Thomas Burr, there's been sort of a firestorm of speculation since this thing was published. Some of that speculation has a Utah connection. And maybe just before we get to that part of this, you can help us make certain that we're all on the same page. What was this opinion piece all about?
Yeah, for the record, I didn't write it.
I feel like
that's the thing these days in Washington to say I didn't write it, so I'm just going to say that real fast. This is one of those things that every day I'm surprised and shocked by what's happening, and I wake up every morning, what's gonna shock me more? The fact that the New York Times ran this op-ed from someone we don't even know who it is, I trust the New York Times knows who it is, and we'll see who, if it ever comes out. Essentially, the New York Times runs this opinion piece by someone who is a senior official in the administration saying pretty much, we know that the president is immoral. He's prone to do things that not based in fact, and yet he wants to do them. We stop him, and essentially, if there's a deep state, as he likes to, the president likes to call it, there's as this author called it, a steady state. So the author of this opinion piece is saying, like, we're trying to do everything we can to stop the president from just going crazy, I guess. So then there was some speculation that who is the author? Who did this? Who is the senior official in the administration to write this? And some speculation came down to John Huntsman. John Huntsman, former Utah governor, didn't necessarily back Trump in the presidential election. In fact, at one point he said that he would, should step down, let Mike Pence lead the ticket. But then took this gig as the ambassador to Russia. So there's some speculation that it was him. I was actually shocked a little bit personally that he actually responded to that. Usually diplomats don't, do that, and they don't really respond to, media suggestions of this or that. But the embassy sent out a statement from the ambassador saying, nope, I'd read it. Huh.
What led people to believe or to think or to speculate, I guess, that it was Huntsman in the first place?
I think there's a few parts of that. One is that, again, he was not part of the campaign. He wasn't supporting the president. He took this job, as many people have speculated before, to be the adult in the room in some ways, to be like, I don't want to do this, but somebody needs to be between, the president and the nuclear button. So that there's part of that. There's also the comments that that John Huntsman made about John McCain, the late senator. His funeral was last Saturday, and John Huntsman was there, and was very grateful for John McCain's service, whereas the president was not even invited to the service. And the letter, the anonymous letter, was very effusive towards John McCain. So there was speculation, well, maybe it's somebody who's really a big part of the John McCain world.
I know that there was also a Utah journalist, Matthew LaPlante, who's also a journalism professor. He tweeted out this theory as well, and he pointed to similarities in language, in the syntax used by the author of this article and John Huntsman. Of course, people have been trying to sort of decipher all of the language in this op-ed for a while.
Yeah, no, I love, for example, I love whoever wrote this. I have my own speculation, but whoever wrote this added the word lodestar,
yeah,
which is essentially like the North Star, the guiding star, which is a word that the vice president has used, Vice President Mike Pence has used several times. So whoever wrote this was probably, if it wasn't Mike Pence, it was probably trying to, like, you know, geared towards people thinking it was Mike Pence,
right,
who wrote this. There's a lot of language in there that was tossed around. Who knows? At the end of the day, I assume we will find out at some point. But it was very interesting written in that we may not know, if not some email chain we're going to find someday.
Dan Harry, government and politics editor at the Salt Lake Tribune. How unusual is this op-ed? I mean, we should say that it's been a pretty kind of, you know, leaky ship inside of the administration, but an anonymous op-ed talking about undermining the president to a certain extent, I don't remember anything similar.
No, it's pretty amazing. The editorial page editor of the Times said they have actually done this four times, that they've published anonymous op-ed pieces, but I think this by far and away is the most controversial, the most high-profile. And they described the reaction to it as, this was a worldwide story. This was an international news, and it set off all kinds of jitters by people worried about an ensuing witch hunt to find out who the source of the letter was. And, you know, to some degree, you have to think that that was sort of anticipated. Obviously, this was going to provoke a reaction from the White House. And we'll see, you know, how far they go in trying to ferret out this person.
And this did infuriate the president. I mean, maybe this is a question for Tommy. He was infuriated by this.
No, just to add to what Dan said, I mean, like, the Washington Post, he was volcanic. I mean,
yeah,
he was very, very upset by this. I mean, and who wouldn't be? This is somebody who, if we trust the Times, and I do, as a senior official, this is somebody inside the White House doing this. This is somebody who literally, who I assume, talks to the president daily, if not every few days. And this is somebody, how can you trust somebody inside your own White House who does that?
Tommy said he had a theory. I kind of want to hear it. Are you willing to tell us who you think it is?
You know what? I probably shouldn't say that on air. I think there are a few people I've talked to in the administration who are frustrated. I'm not sure I want to name them on air, but
okay.
I think that if you look at people who have been somewhat, put it this way, look at people who are frustrated with the administration, but still in a position, and I'll just leave it there.
Okay, that's great. Go ahead, Dan Harry.
I just want to make one comment, too, about the timing of this. It comes right on the heels of the release of Bob Woodward's book, and it describes many officials, senior officials in the White House, who are doing this kind of thing. They're not saying it in op-ed pieces, but they're taking actions, according to Woodward, like stealing papers off the president's desk to keep him from withdrawing from trade agreements, and the Secretary of Defense ignoring the president's demands that he assassinate a foreign leader. So the timing of that's really interesting, because it's basically saying the same thing as this anonymous author did.
Wow. George Pyle, just before we leave this topic and turn to other news, you're an editorial page editor. What did you make of this opinion piece in the Times, and maybe in particular the anonymity that the Times agreed to for the author?
Well, we don't do anonymous, so don't send me any anonymous op-eds. Although,
I was going to send you one today.
Okay, well, maybe from you, but of course, usually when I get an op-ed that they want to be anonymous, frequently they don't even want me to know who they are, and I'm not going there. I would need to know who they were, and it would have to be something that, like this, like the New York Times piece, that we had reason to believe was not going to come out another way, right. was really clued the people in on something that the American people really need to know. Now, you could argue that we already know it. You could argue that this person is not helping very much, that this person, if he really has this much of a problem with the president, with the way the White House is run, they should speak up, they should resign, they should speak up publicly, they should go to Congress, they should go on TV and say, this is what I saw, this is unacceptable, I don't think that we should run a country this way. And then some of the reaction has been, well, what this person is trying to do maybe is even give us a little bit of a false sense of security by saying, we know the president's unhinged, but don't worry. You know, the steady state, the permanent government, which all advanced nations have and couldn't function without, you know, we're watching him, so don't worry. So because these are people that are this is a person who apparently approves of the Trump tax cuts, who approves of deregulation, who approves of, you know, taking away most of what the Environmental Protection Agency does, who approves of less of the free trade approach that Republicans used to have and is okay with some of the president's tariffs and things. But what they want to do is take the roughest edge off of the weird stuff like ordering assassinations and pulling us out of trade treaties that we've been in for a long time and convincing the president that it's okay, we'll do it next week. And I guess this is more the Woodward book than the op-ed, but convincing the president, we'll fire this person, we'll launch this attack, we'll withdraw from this trade treaty, but it'll take us a while to do the paperwork, so don't worry about it, hoping he'll forget, and often enough he does, that he isn't asking them, you know, what happened to this, what happened to that, because his mind has moved, such as it is, has moved on to something else. Mm.
Of course, that undermining led to his one-word tweet reply, treason. And it's interesting times that we live in.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what's really scary is that this president doesn't understand government at all. And he has no clue as to the rule of law, as to the separation of powers, as to what presidents can and cannot just order on their own. I mean, he's just clueless and proudly so, it seems sometimes. So, yeah, the fact that maybe there are some adults in the room who are Republicans who like tax cuts, but you know where to draw the line. I mean, like P.G. O'Rourke, a conservative columnist, came out for Hillary Clinton during the last campaign. He said, she's wrong about everything, but she's wrong within normal parameters, as opposed to Trump, who's just way out there. So,
hey, George, just for the record, did you write the op-ed?
No.
Okay. Oh,
no. I if it would have been better if I had written.
I keep asking everyone I know.
Well, yeah. Well, you have to. Yeah.
He seems like he has some of the language that George has been using is very similar. No, I'm kidding.
Did he use the word lodestar?
Yeah. No, I don't think I've ever used that word.
A reminder that,
start.
That George Pyle is the editorial voice here in the room. And listeners, you're invited to join our conversation. The number to call, 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Let's stick with the news out of Washington for a bit. Thomas Burr, confirmation hearings for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, those were taking place and have been taking place this week. Confirmation hearings punctuated by seemingly endless protests from the gallery, a lot of arrests as a result. Before we get to the meat of these hearings, just on these protests, Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, who is a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee where these hearings are taking place, he wasn't very pleased about these disruptions, these protests. Can you tell us about that?
No, and he's the former chairman of the committee, right. And he was not happy with how the proceedings have gone. And I've actually lost count because there's been about 70 or so people arrested every day in these hearings. And you see them, they're interrupting even Democrats trying to ask their questions. It's pretty amazing. And I've covered, this is my sixth confirmation hearing. I think I've covered for the Judiciary Committee, and it's quite amazing. These protests have gotten even more obtrusive in some ways to the hearings. They'll shout out things, and the senator from Utah, Mr. Orrin Hatch, has not been happy with them. At one point, he said they should not be allowed in the room. That we should ban them in some ways. But how do you know who's a protester? If you look at the hearings, they look like, you know, normal people walking in the room, and all of a sudden they stand up and start shouting.
Yeah, and he, you know, he talked about them being insolent, and I'm sure that insolence is exactly what the protesters were going for.
Exactly.
This is obviously an enormous deal for the court, Trump's second pick for the high court. Senator Hatch is also a big cheerleader for Brett Kavanaugh, Tommy. Is that correct?
Yeah, of course, and as is Senator Mike Lee in so many ways. Hatch is probably leading the way. Mike Lee, you know, is a big supporter as well, but Hatch has a lot of sway on the Judiciary Committee. And there's no question that Hatch is lobbing some softballs at Kavanaugh and asking him to explain, giving him time. Which, if you ever watched the hearing, you know, Democrats will ask a question and give him like 3 seconds to respond. So Hatch's idea is, well, let me ask you the question and give you as much time as you want in a nice setting for you to respond. The senator has said he's going to lift heaven and earth to get Kavanaugh through, and he proved it this week. He was trying to help him as much as he can to explain away some concerns and also discuss his, his college love of pasta and ketchup. Hmm. But, you know, that's
the kind of softball we're getting. Okay.
Yeah.
Republicans have a 2-vote majority in the Senate. Does that mean that he's going to be confirmed, that Kavanaugh is going to be confirmed?
Yeah, in many ways, that's part of it, because we're not at the 60-vote threshold anymore, where you used to have to have at least, you know, 60 votes to get to pass the filibuster, and then you could actually vote. It's a very arcane situation, but now we're down to simple majority. Hmm. And there are also some red state Democrats, thinking of Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who's in a tough spot, who will probably have to vote for this candidate if he wants to win re-election.
You wrote a little bit about the impact on the court and what it will be. Tommy, do you want to tackle that one, and then I'll throw it to the editorial voice here in the room.
Yeah, sure. That'll be fun to hear the editorial side. I think there's no question any observer at the Supreme Court will see that this changes the court. Anthony Kennedy, who Kavanaugh would replace, has been seen as the swing vote. He's, when there are 5-4 votes, he's often that fifth vote. And Kennedy has been, somewhat, he'll side with the conservative side, he'll side with the Democratic side, liberal side sometimes, depending on the thing. He's been fun to watch. And in this situation, if Kavanaugh is confirmed, from everyone I talked to, it looks like John Roberts, a Bush appointee, may actually become the swing vote.
George Pyle, for these protesters and for a lot of liberals, the sky is falling in America with this nominee. Can you talk about your view of the impact on the court?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of concern, and I think backed up by some of these memos that the Democrats have leaked, even though they were violating their Senate rules to do so, apparently, does give one pause to think that Kavanaugh has gone around talking to senators, especially like female Republican senators, and telling them, don't worry, you know, Roe versus Wade is settled law, we're not going to upset that precedent. And then they find these memos from him saying, well, no, it's not settled law, and the Supreme Court can always overturn a precedent, which is true. A Supreme Court can always overturn a precedent. They've done so many times. It kind of depends on whether you think this justice is the one who's going to vote to do that. That's what makes him different from Anthony Kennedy is although he would sometimes come down on what we would say is the conservative side, I think to a large degree Anthony Kennedy thought the conservative side was individual liberty and privacy, and which supports Roe versus Wade, which supports same-sex marriage and that kind of thing. Those were individual human dignity and privacy things, which Kennedy probably really didn't see as radical or liberal. He kind of thought that was more conservative. That's a different kind of conservative than the person we're looking at now. And, you know, as these memos come out, it's sounding more and more like he's telling the committee one thing and he's told his previous employers an entirely different thing, that he's telling the committee, I wasn't involved in this, I wasn't involved in that, and he was. And so, but still, you're going to have to swing a vote, and, you know, as Tommy said, red state Democrats may vote for him. There's a lot of pressure on Susan Collins in Maine, and a senator from Alaska to, because it'll only take a couple.
Yeah,
the Senate is so evenly divided, you lose two Republican votes, you could lose it.
Sounds like it's, almost a done deal. Tommy.
Roger, sorry. This is a generational shift, if I can be pontificating for 2 seconds. This is a point where the court changes for a lifetime, because it's a lifetime appointment. And this isn't some little change where you replace a conservative with a conservative or a liberal with a liberal. This is a swing in the court, as many people would say, and that's why the Democrats are going to try to bring up everything they can possibly bring up, even though they know they probably can't stop him, because this is a really big change.
You know, Dan Harry, government and politics editor, just before we head to a break, Senator Orrin Hatch has been involved in a lot of these confirmation hearings, as Tommy was pointing out. This will almost certainly, you never know, but this will probably be his last confirmation hearing. I actually don't know if there's a question there, more of an observation. Any comments on that legacy of Hatch and his role?
No matter what you think of Orrin Hatch, there's no doubt he has had a big hand in shaping the judiciary, and he's been part of this effort. You know, they've called it the 30-year plan to put a lot of conservatives on the courts from top to bottom, and not only at the national level, but here in Utah, I don't think you can look at any of the current sitting federal judges or the emeritus judges, and every one of them has been basically Orrin Hatch's pick. That's how strong an influence he's had. And of course, once he leaves the Senate, I think you'll see the federal court building, that god-awful cube downtown, will bear the Orrin G. Hatch name. So.
All right. Something to...
Can I just add
sure,
real fast? One of those things that is still one of those great facts in America that people don't really know is Ruth Bader Ginsburg is on the Supreme Court because of Orrin Hatch.
Right.
He had suggested that her name to President Clinton, and President Clinton did nominate her, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, probably the liberals' favorite justice on the court, is there because Orrin Hatch suggested her.
I mean, what does that say about how nominations happen now versus then? You could go on for a while.
I could talk for an hour about that. But used to be that justices were confirmed like 97-1 or something like that. It was amazing how I looked back at the votes, and it used to be like, you know, you're qualified, you're good, and now it's a really, really big fight. And if Kavanaugh is confirmed, as I assume he will probably be, it will be like 51-49.
Dan Harry.
Just a footnote to what Tommy was saying about Orrin Hatch being responsible for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You know, he did the same thing with Merrick Garland last year. And Obama did nominate Merrick Garland. And then Hatch's support, along with all the other Republicans, disappeared.
Evaporated. Polarized times, I guess. Guys, with that, we have to head to our first break of the show and actually say farewell to Tommy Burr there in Washington. Thomas Burr in Washington. Tommy, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Roger.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. When we come back, more from this past week's news. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay tuned.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. You might know him as Captain Kirk, you might know him as T.J. Hooker, but did you know William Shatner started out as an understudy for Christopher Plummer, or that he starred in a film where he had to learn an invented language? William Shatner tells stories from his life that I guarantee you, you've never heard before. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Next time on Ask Me Another, actor Ntare Guma Mumbaho Mwine talks about feeling a little out of place in New Orleans while working on the HBO series Tremé.
Being a vegetarian, and I also don't drink,
it's the worst place.
They thought I was an alien.
Join me, Ophir Eisenberg, on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Saturday morning at 10 on UPR.
With you, rock.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry and editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. It is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments. 801-355-8255 is the number to call, or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, I want to turn to the election that is coming up in November and the ballot initiatives that we will see on the ballot as well. Medical marijuana among them, or expanded medical marijuana, I should say. Medicine for people who aren't just terminally ill, that will be on the ballot. Recently, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints came out against this initiative, but it turns out that even after that, there's still a fair amount of support in Utah, according to some recent polling, for this ballot initiative.
Right. Utah Policy commissioned a poll with Dan Jones and Associates that they published this week. It was begun the day before the church's official joining of the opposition and lasted for, I think, 3 or 4 days afterward.
Okay.
So it picked up most of what we would see from that change. Maybe some of that needs to be digested and worked through the political body before, you know, we can really see the effect. But the initial effect is, yeah, it does seem to have certainly diminished the support of active Mormons. When we do the polling, they question the demographics. Part of it is, are you an active member of the LDS Church? And those who describe themselves that way, they saw, according to this poll, about a 9 percentage point drop in support. And so it went from a majority, a small majority of active Mormons supporting the initiative, to a small majority opposing the initiative. Hmm. So about an 8 to 9 point swing, according to that poll.
How about among voters?
Overall, if you are a supporter of the initiative, you're probably pretty happy with the overall result because it's still 2 to 1 in support across all demographics, according to this poll, which had a large sample. It was about 809 voters. And, so it's about 60% to 32% against, something like that.
Is that a surprise? I mean, especially given this, you know, the 9 point drop, well, not for ignoring the 9 point drop, but especially given the position of the church, is the fact that it remains popular, at least in this polling, and I know polling can be interesting to look at,
yeah,
especially when it comes to how people vote in the end. But is that surprising?
Well, in some ways, yes. I would say that, you know, it's no surprise that the church is coming out against this. They've been making baby steps toward this for a long time. At first, they issued a statement praising the Utah Medical Association's opposition to medical marijuana. Next, they had their attorneys draft up a whole lot of reasons why you wouldn't want legalized medical marijuana, and they said, "Oh, these raise grave concerns about what we should do here." And so it was pretty clear they are moving in that direction. And then the other day, they fully embraced the opposition, joined the coalition, had a general authority there to make sure that nobody could miss the point. This was coming from the very top. And then they sent out emails to members urging people to vote against it. Now, I think what we're going to see from here on out, although, as you may guess, I don't sit in those high councils, so I don't know this for sure. But my prediction is that you will see a continual campaign on the part of church leaders, messages read over the pulpit, emails, trying to get people to volunteer to oppose this initiative. So I think that will step up here in the next few weeks. And at that point, you know, it may have a bigger effect than it's had so far.
And I'm sure we will see more polling before...
We will see more polling. The Tribune will do some polling in October.
Okay. George Pyle, just there's another aspect of this that I want to turn to. But before we do that, the church exerting its influence and then this polling showing a little bit of a drop among active church members, but overall still wide support. What do you think about that?
Well, it's possible they waited too late to weigh in. I mean, we're still a couple of, almost 2 months from the election. Yeah. But a lot of people have heard about this, and, more so than any candidate, more so than any other kind of, nuts and bolts proposition like the anti-gerrymandering thing. The, medical marijuana is kind of an emotional gut issue rather than a brain issue in a lot of ways. And Mormons or any religious group generally pride themselves on compassion, on, healing the sick and taking care of people who are in a bad way. And if you're able to show them that medical marijuana is one way to do that, then they will make up their own minds based on their religious underpinnings, that this is a good thing to do. It helps people. And if the hierarchy of the church says otherwise, well, they've been wrong before. And it's a question, too, of whether the church, learned anything from the Proposition 8 in California, where they won the election, but they really got stung in terms of popular support, even from a lot of their own members, as to whether they were properly being active in this kind of thing. Constitutionally, they have every right. It's not a kind of thing where they're endorsing a candidate for Congress or something. That's the kind of thing where you can, your tax exemption can get
messed up.
Right,
as a nonprofit. Sure.
This is the kind of thing that could hurt them in the long run. If this passes, over their objections, then you're really going to have to wonder how much influence do they really have.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up that hierarchical. I mean, is it a form of obedience within the church to adhere to what the church is telling you to do? I mean, roughly telling you to do at the polling at the ballot box, or disobedience, I guess would be the way to put it.
Well, I think the LDS Church was in a tough position here because you have legalized medical marijuana in about 30 states already. And never before has the church come out and said, you should not be using medical marijuana because if you do, we consider that, a violation of your fealty to the church and its principles, and we won't give you a temple recommend. They haven't done that. And so, therefore, by default, all of these Mormons in these states that have legalized marijuana think that they're fine. They can do this with no problem. Now, all of a sudden, Utah comes along, and this is getting a little too close to home. And so the church comes out with this. But at the same time, they say they oppose the initiative. They say we support legalized marijuana under certain circumstances.
Right.
Now, there's a lot of questions about what circumstances those are, because the ones they outlined don't exist anywhere. Nowhere can a doctor prescribe medical marijuana in the United States and have that marijuana dispense through a licensed pharmacy. It does not exist.
Because it contradicts federal law. Speaking of all of this, actually, Dan, and I think that there's an obvious tie-in, the opponents of this ballot initiative, among them are the faith itself, but there are specific groups that are opposing this initiative, and they have been running some opposition advertising on TV and on radio. But some of this advertising has recently been pulled from stations because of criticism that it was inaccurate. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we're just aware of the one radio station, and there may be more, but we're aware of at least one that has pulled the radio ads. These were based on complaints that began with the opposition, the initiative supporters, and also they had listeners call in. The station, The Eagle, which pulled the ads, said that they'd received something like 53 complaints about the ads on air. And so they pulled them, they said, to examine the content of the ads to see if they, in fact, were untrue and deceitful to the listeners. Mm. So they haven't come out with a conclusion on that. Essentially, the message of the ads is that if you vote for Proposition 2, this initiative, you're going to legalize essentially recreational marijuana. Right. And that's going to be the number one campaign theme of opponents is the initiative does not have the safeguards in place to keep this from somebody getting a recommendation from a physician that then they use in perpetuity to get medical marijuana and use it for, you know, just recreation.
It seems like there is that perception, though, that this is about recreational marijuana use. And, of course, proponents will say, no, this is about helping people who have who have medical. So this is what about repercussions for doctors who do how would you police that? That's a very interesting thing to
I don't know how you would
about.
Police that. I mean, under the way that it would be set up is a doctor would recommend medical marijuana, which is not the same thing as prescribing it. Hmm. And I don't really know that there's any prohibition from them doing that.
Hmm. George Pyle, your comments on these advertisements that sound – I mean, they're pulled from at least one radio station for the idea that they might be misleading. And also just the battle over this medical marijuana ballot initiative, which would expand the extant but very limited medical marijuana law here in Utah.
Yeah, I mean, that's – I mean, this is going to get nasty. I mean, we're talking maybe later about you know, Mia Love and Ben McAdams getting nasty. This is going to be nasty. People on both sides are really dug in. The people on both sides so far have had no compunction about saying that the people on the other side are lying. Right now, my personal opinion, I'm sticking with Steve Urquhart on this. The antis are saying some things that I just don't think are true. I mean, they're saying that this initiative is for recreational marijuana. I don't think that's true. They're saying that we already have medical marijuana in Utah. Well, it's so limited that that statement is essentially not true. We had some people from the medical association and on the anti side come in to see the editorial board about a week or so ago, and I just don't think they're being straight with us. Hmm. Now there are people on the pro side who will. The fact, I mean, we're having to make this up as we go along. I mean, even though 30 other states have done it, and they've looked at the other states, and they've looked at what seems to work out, with it being illegal at the federal level, with it being illegal for a doctor to really give you a prescription that you can't read anyway, and go to a pharmacist, and we can't do that. So we're having to make up this other thing. And there will always be a way that somebody can game the system. There will always be a way that you know, somebody will take the medical marijuana that they, you know, they really do have chronic pain or wasting problems or something, and the doctor will give them a card and they'll go and they'll get it. And, you know, people who are, you know, in you know, it's really hard. Maybe they're on disability, they can't work, you know, maybe selling a little bit of that on the side. Of course that's going to happen. I was in San Francisco a couple of summers ago. Guy walks out of the medical marijuana dispensary, walks 3 yards, sells some of it to this guy standing on the street corner, and the security guard who's watching the dispensary, he's not a police officer, he's a security guard to make sure the place doesn't get ripped off. He just stands there. He doesn't do anything. Right. Nobody gives him a second look. So it's going to leak out. Of course it is. Huh. But I think part – and also a big part of what this is a kick in the pants to Big Pharma, to the medical society, to as a whole – for what they've done to us with opioids. Mm. This is a way of saying, we're tired of what you've done to us. You told us opioids were safe and effective. The medical establishment told us that opioids were safe and effective. The federal government told us that opioids were safe and effective and not addictive. Well, those people were lying to us. And I offered the anti-marijuana people a deal. Vote down Prop 2. Find a few people with Big Pharma. 20-year hard federal sentence. I'd make that deal.
You would make that deal. George Pyle is on board for that. You know, George, you presaged something that I want to turn to after we come back from another break, and that is the attack, the negative campaigning in the Mia Love, Ben McAdams race. And we will do that after we come back from another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
This week on Undisciplined, we're talking about the ways in which we manage our bodies, our minds, and our environments. Joining us are Eric Pepper, whose recent studies have investigated the ways in which posture impacts performance, and Brady Mattson, whose recent study examines how natural resource officials can best share their expertise and experiences in managing protected areas. That's Undisciplined, Friday at 2.
I think the main reason why I love Bullseye is Jesse's ability to really ask sincere questions, not just because he's trying to get an interesting answer, but because he seems to really want to know.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week, I'll talk with blue-eyed soul legend Boz Scaggs, plus podcast host, comic, and author Maeve Higgins. That's on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Tomorrow afternoon at 1 on UPR.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry and George Pyle. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. Well, from attack ads in a ballot initiative battle to attacks in a competitive election for U.S. House of Representatives, sorry about that. Dan Harry, the Mia Love, Ben McAdams race has been turning negative. And it might be more accurate to say that it's becoming a little bit more negative because I think it already was to a certain extent there. How is that happening? What form is that negativity taking?
Well, so the Love campaign sent out fundraising emails, and they are once again, as they've done several times this year, tried to paint Ben McAdams as sort of a radical liberal, and trying to tie him to Nancy Pelosi and tie him to voting for abortion rights and voting for same-sex marriage, you know, supporting that. And, you know, McAdams several times has come back and just, it sounds like he's kind of fed up with this. He's like, I'm a moderate, you know, stop trying to attack me. And the subtle message underlying it is, I am a good LDS member, just like you, Mia. And so stop attacking me. You know, I'm not a liberal. I'm a moderate. And we've seen this back and forth. I don't know that it's moved the needle any on this race. The most recent polling on this, we don't know much about the details of the poll, but this was for the debate commission,
right,
which is deciding who gets invited to these statewide debates in the congressional and Senate race. And they showed about a 9 percentage point spread between Love and McAdams, and that's the biggest we've seen. Generally speaking, this has been between a 5 and 6 percentage point spread, and pretty close when you consider the margin of error. It has been a pretty close race,
but maybe not as competitive as it had been.
Well,
depending upon this,
we don't know that much about the poll, so I'm not putting a great deal of reliance on it.
As you would expect, the Love campaign is touting those poll numbers, and the McAdams campaign is downplaying them.
Sure. Yeah. They're claiming, McAdams people are claiming that their internal polling, which again, we don't know much about, so I don't put much stake in it, is about 2 percentage point difference.
Well, you know, there are other races around the state for federal office going on right
there
now.
There are.
Representative Rob Bishop's district, the 1st District, for example. Mm-hmm. And there are, as you mentioned, also debates coming up soon. And there's been polling by the Utah Debate Commission. Mm-hmm. In the 1st District, it's not going to be just Bishop and he's a Republican and his Democratic counterpart, who's Lee Castillo. It's mm-hmm. also going to be another person
Eric
on that debate.
Eliason, yeah, who's a United Utah Party. And he's put a lot of his own money into it. And so he's spent money. If you've seen the ads, it's time to, release the bishop? I think, are the ads.
Yeah.
And playing off the church language there. So he spent some money. He's got enough in this debate commission's poll to make the debate. And
where's he from? I mean, what's his what party is he with? I guess is the question to ask.
What party is he? He's United Utah.
Okay, great.
Party, which is that new fledgling party that started a year ago, and they claim to be made up of disgruntled Republicans and Democrats who feel like our politics is too polarized, and that we are really the voice of moderation. So they're trying to make a name for themselves, and they were very happy that he made the cut to be on the debate stage. But, you know, in the end, their poll showed him getting like 6.6%.
Right. Which was in the margin of error of 10%,
right,
which allows him to be on this debate stage.
But, you know, it's a good thing for him to be able to be on the stage now with the major candidate. He'll get publicity that he wouldn't have got. He'll be taken more seriously. And, you know, you hear the third-party candidates complain about these rules that exclude most of them from the debates. I mean, they have a point. They are not getting their message out there. Number one, they don't have money. And number two, these public events that they don't have to pay to get on air with are excluding them.
Hmm. This is not the first time that a United Utah Party candidate has made it to the debate stage. Last year,
Jim Bennett,
yeah,
was running in the 3rd District.
Hmm. Okay, well, a third party sort of beginning to
we'll see.
Find its
I mean, you know,
in Utah, sorry.
People think that Utah may be ready for it. The Democrats have been downtrodden here for so long, and as we saw in the last presidential election, you had an independent candidate that came in, and you know, he didn't win the election here for president, but he got quite a few votes.
Okay. Just quickly, I want to go back to a topic we were covering before because we had a call from a listener who didn't stay on the line, but this is Sierra from Salt Lake City talking about marijuana, medical marijuana. She says that she thinks marijuana is already a problem with kids getting stuff from Colorado. What does the panel think about that? Take it or leave it. What do you think about that, actually?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what when you do this state by state, then, yeah, people are going to go to the state where they cross the border. And, you know, there's the argument would having medical marijuana or recreational marijuana in the states that have that, is that an economic development tool? Does that recruit business or does that scare it away? And that's part of the thing. We're going to be inundated with studies and references and links and things that are or claim to be scientific that say, well, the experience in Colorado has been this or the experience in Oregon has been that. And they will tell you addiction is up. No, it isn't. Driving under the influence is up. No, it isn't. And what it's going to come down to really is, are people willing to accept a little bit of that, which will happen, in order to have the goal of this, which is to help people with AIDS and epilepsy and things like that, get the relief that certain kinds of marijuana offers.
Except for in those recreational states. I mean, yeah. Where the goal is something different.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing that the opponents are really going to hit pretty hard, yeah, is, and they're already saying it, is that either this will lead to recreational marijuana, which has kind of been what the governor's argued, or it is, they'll say, mm-hmm, recreational marijuana. I would challenge that. But yeah, every place that's got recreational marijuana did medical marijuana first. So if you're worried about that, that can be the kind of thing that helps you make a decision.
A gateway decision. Go ahead.
Well, I would say Sierra's correct. I mean, I think people are going to Colorado and bringing marijuana back. I don't know if they're kids. I think it's an 18-year-old. Isn't it 18 is the age that you can legally purchase marijuana in Colorado? I would think it's 18. But anyway, in the United States, we've decided that our borders, our state borders, are pretty porous. Mm. You know, you can go in and outside of Utah, and there's nobody, there's no guards at the state line that are checking your trunk of your car, and I think we like it that way. I think that's a deliberate choice that we have made, and you know, there are some downsides of that, and this may be one of them. That Utah right now has decided that medical marijuana should not be legal. The limited bill we have, really, I don't count that as medical marijuana. It's pretty small. But we've decided that as a state so far. That could change. But Colorado's made a different decision, and there's going to be some spillover from other states. There's no doubt about that.
And then, you know, one of the arguments that also is, you know, all these states that have gone either medical or recreational marijuana, I mean, the tide is coming. The tide is turning. It's going to be practically nationwide pretty soon. The states that have gone for this are not going back. And so
some of that is economics, too.
And, well, a lot of it is economics. They're making a ton of tax money off of this, and which, you know, that tends to be the recreational argument, is how much taxes you make off of it. It's coming. And is this the way we're going to deal with it, or is it some other way? But we're going to have to deal with it.
Okay. Well, with that, you guys, Sierra, thank you very much for your call. We are going to have to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And this is where we highlight stories that could use more coverage or that maybe just stood out for us. And George Pyle, maybe I'll stick with you. Do you want to start us off with an underplayed story if you're ready?
Well, I mean, like I always say, if it's underplayed, I haven't seen it. But the story, I think, bears watching. There's still a lot of controversy and a lot of work to be done in San Juan County about the Navajos and the election they're going to have there. And the state is just going to have to step in because the county officials just aren't credible in this.
Dan Harry, you want to run
with it? He snatched that from under me.
I'm sorry.
Do you want to elaborate on that, though? There was the Navajo are complaining about Navajo residents of San Juan County are complaining about how they are put into different districts down there. I mean, or how they're on the polls, I guess.
Right. It's an interesting thing. The county is saying that this is almost impossible to do because a lot of the Navajos list post office boxes as their address, as we saw in the case of Willie Gray Eyes, the Democrat who was kicked off the ballot and then reinstated by a judge. He had a post office box in Arizona, and the county was using that as one of the reasons it was citing to say, oh, he's not really a resident of Utah and not eligible to vote. Well, P.O. boxes really are not have anything to do with your residence. I mean, some of these people drive miles and miles to get to the post office to pick up their mail. So as somebody who's trying to put these precinct maps together and decide what ballot you get, that can be tough. But this is part of that continuing resolution of what's going on in San Juan County.
Definitely a story we will keep watching. You know, for my part, I'm going to go with there's a vile smell in West Valley City, and it's even forcing people to move. Taylor Stevens and Courtney Tanner at the Tribune get to the bottom of that. You can check it out at sltrib.com.
Smell something, say something.
Smells. Patent that, Dan. Dan Harry and George Pyle with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you.
And thanks to Tommy Berg, who joined us earlier on the show. And that wraps up our show. I want to thank Jesse Ellis, who's our operations and programming director here at KCPW. Thanks, Jesse, for your technical help. Also to the staff of Utah Public Radio and to our producer, Emily Means. Thanks to you, as always, for tuning in as well. Please join us again next week for another edition of Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend.
Make an appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Faster on Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour in healthy living, including this recipe for
spinach and chicken tortilla casserole.
We always have a great time. So will you on Zorba Faster on Your Health from PRX.
Tune in Sunday afternoon at noon on Utah Public Radio.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan, also heard at upr.org.